Welcome to Mysterious Goings On, the podcast about creativity, writing, and mystery. Every week, we talk about all kinds of great fiction and meet the people who write it. We also feature explorations about creativity in all walks of life. Your host, Alex Greenwood, will join you right after this.
Why do authors love mysterious goings-on? Let me count the ways, but here's a great one from author Linda Stuart Henley, author of Kate's War.
Well, thank you, Alex. I enjoyed the conversation, and I appreciated the fact that you were able to say all the right things, so I didn't have to say them myself, like repeatedly say, please read Kate's War. I didn't want to do that. That's not for me to say, but you could say it better, and you did. And thank you so very much.
Well, welcome back to Mysterious Goings On, where the unexplained and the expertly explained are met with equal measures of curiosity and respect. You like that one, folks? I kind of worked on that one. I've been workshopping that one since 2016. I'm proud of it. Anyway, today we're set to unravel some of the mind's most compelling mysteries with our guest, Dr. Gary Simons. As the pioneering chief of neurosurgery and neurosurgery residency program director at the Carilion Clinic, I believe that's correct how you pronounce it, and the Virginia Tech Carilion School of Medicine, Dr. Simons shaped minds and lives until his retirement from clinical practice in 2020. Yet his influence continues unabated as a professor at the Virginia Tech School of Neuroscience through his national and international teaching and his literary work that captures the complexities of our psyche in his medical psychological thriller, Death's Pale Flag. I really am legitimately, seriously, totally thrilled to have the opportunity to speak with a professional of such stature who definitely bridges the realms of medical education and captivating storytelling. Dr. Gary Simons, welcome to Mysterious Goings On.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Alex. It's an honor and a pleasure.
It's all mine. You know, I told you offline, you know, I've interviewed surgeons and physicians, but I think you're our first neurosurgeon. And I'm taken back to my first, I used to be a public relations guy. I still am. Go figure, right? But I was at a medical school, University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center. And part of my job, Dr. Simons, was to do a column for the local newspapers where I would interview physicians at the school, teachers at the school. I'm sure you've done it, right? I'm sure, you've got to help the PR department out. And I just remember that, and I hate to put everybody in like a silo, but I'm going to, here I go. The cardiologists were not a lot of fun. They just did not want to do it, right? But the neurologists and the neurosurgeons were a hoot to talk to, because I think one of them, and I'm paraphrasing, I asked him, I was very young. I asked him, you know, doctors are God, so he'll know. I was like, I'm just curious, doctor, how does the mind actually work? And he just looked at me and said, I have no idea. Tell us about that, if you would, though, as a neurosurgeon. Do you think people have an understanding about what you do and the brain itself? Or how do you feel about that?
No, it's a great question, Alex. And please call me Gary. But it's part of the reason why I wrote the novel. I've written a bunch of nonfiction stuff before. I really wanted to kind of draw the curtains back on the neurosurgical world, particularly in the modern era. You know, I think it's a big black box to most people, and it's pretty terrifying. And I'm not quite sure the book is going to de-terrify it, but at least hopefully it open people's eyes.
Well, is it... I mean, from your perspective, and obviously you would be the one to ask, is do we as humanity, do we fully understand how the brain works? And I know that's that same question I asked before when I was younger. I'm asking you again, because do we actually really understand how consciousness can reside in this organ?
Yeah, no, absolutely not. You can see that debated all the time. It just circles round and round and round. And in the neuroscience literature, which means nobody has it completely pinned down. You know, we have a lot of information about how various components of this system works, but how it all finally puts things together and does what we do, it is still very much a mystery.
It is, and it's interesting on the other side of the ledger, as we're talking, you're a writer, I'm a writer, is, but, you know, poetically, people will often, you know, they say, you know, where is the human soul located? And people will point to the heart, right? You know, which, you know, heart is actually a pump, you know, and whereas the brain to me is so much more romantic because it's a mystery organ. Because as you just iterated, we don't know. And anyway, I find that fascinating. And I that's kind of the direction I was trying to go through here before we start talking about the book, was because I just think, particularly me as a mystery writer and a thriller writer, I love the idea of the brain being such a mysterious repository or resting place for what I perceive to be whatever a soul is, consciousness, if you will. So I think it's funny, but I just have to ask you this though, too. I'd like to ask about your transition. You were a surgeon, correct?
Correct.
So you were digging around in people's craniums here. I'm not to be crass. That was crass. Sorry. But how long were you actually a surgeon performing work on people's brains?
Well, I started, you know, you start pretty much right out of medical school and what's called a residency. And in neurosurgery, it was 7 years of residency. And back in those days, it was about 110 hours a week in the hospital.
Wow.
Every third night, or often every other night, we would be up all night, you know, running around dealing with emergencies and stuff. So that all began way back in, I guess, 1984. So for quite a while, for decades, I've been involved in the business. I will say, you know, just to backtrack a little for you, you know, if
Please.
We want to get into the mystery of it all, as I said, I'm not sure we're ever going to figure it out. There's, you know, 80 billion or 100 billion nerve cells in our brains. And then we're beginning to realize that a bunch of the other cells that are there too, called the glial cells, are important in our function. But I think one of the most fascinating components about it all is every one of these nerve cells has hundreds, if not thousands, of connections with other nerve cells. So the wiring diagram is beyond comprehension, number one. And number two, what's most fascinating about it is the wiring diagram is changing all the time. So everything that we do, everything that we experience, everything we hear, see, feel, think, changes that wiring diagram to one degree or another, at least on the very microscopic level, where one nerve is talking to another nerve. That's constantly in flux. It's constantly changing. We're making new connections. We're shutting down certain connections. We're up ramping some. We're down ramping some. So it's constantly changing. It's not like a computer where you just, you know, everything gets hooked up and that's what you got.
Right.
Our brains are constantly changing. So to be able to think that we can fully understand how one brain works versus another, or to ever believe that any of us experience reality the exact same way and are going to react to reality in the exact same way is crazy.
I so appreciate you telling us that, because that's the thing. I always wonder if, just to your point, like when I write my characters, I'm often thinking, and you've heard that term, oh, that guy, he has a head full of bad wiring. He's, you know, you kind of mm-hmm. back to the wiring, but you just wonder if particularly like I had this is very original, a very sociopathic bad guy, although imagine that, right? But it was just like, but he saw the world as if it was, that's how it's supposed to be, and that he was doing just the right things, and it, never mind the fact that it hurt other people. And I'm just wondering if that perception, his brain, I guess that was the way things are supposed to be, whereas maybe to more of us, that's like reprehensible behavior. It kind of reminds me of Young Frankenstein, where Igor gets the brain that's marked Abby something.
Abby, right? Normal.
Abby normal. But is there, and I want to get right into your book here, but I'm just to lead up to that, I was going to ask you though, I mean, I have a feeling you're going to tell me probably we don't know, but again on this, but Has there any evidence, though, that people who are divergent from the general acceptable behavior in a society have different brains or different wiring, as you're talking about, or is it just too hard to tell?
Yeah, no, I think there is good evidence at some levels. I would argue, you know, going back to what I was saying, I would argue that we're all neurodivergent. There is no one single blueprint that we all follow or we're supposed to follow. There are major networks in our brains that are pretty comparable from one person to another, but you get down to the microcircuitry and it's, you know, we are going to be completely different. And that, and you know, I just wrote a little piece for Psychology Today Online that was talking about this whole idea of how we're always looking down on people for not pulling up their bootstraps, you know, pulling themselves up from their bootstraps, if you will. And I kind of challenged it, saying, you know, this is either going to be metaphysical or it's going to be neurological. If it's metaphysical, you know, God handed our personalities out to us, I guess. And, you know, how can we blame someone who gets a personality that has a little less gumption or a little less go get it? But if you go purely on the neuroscience side of it, you know, our drive, our gumption, our intelligence, all this stuff is afforded us by our neuroconnectivity and our neuroarchitecture. And, you know, we didn't choose it. I didn't choose my brain. This is what I was given. And so how can we be so condescending when we run into neurodivergency, if you will, that is less functional? But I guess ultimately, you know, when you look at us, you know, to function as a society, you have to draw the line somewhere, right? You got to say this sort of behavior, even if the person isn't, you know, actually responsible for it, even if it's not their fault, this sort of behavior we can't accept because it's unhealthy for our society. So there's going to be a bell-shaped curve in almost any human function, if you will, or human emotion or human thought. And I think we're all, you know, most of us fall under the bell-shaped curve, but if you get a standard deviation or two out of it, I think we as a society say, whoa, 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 you know, that's too much. And we've got to do something about it. And when you do, so to get to your very good and important question, I think when we do study people who are way outside the bell-shaped curve on certain things, like, you know, psychopaths or something like that, we often do find that there are significant differences in the way their brains function. I'm not sure we can categorize them all and say, yes, everyone has this dysfunction. But we definitely, you know, there's all sorts of articles out there, you know, doing these sort of neurofunctioning studies based on functional MRIs and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think we can definitely say that there is going to be significant deviations from the kind of standard wiring that we see that's out there. But boy, when you get from one person to another person, we have no way of really sorting that one out.
Talk about a mystery. Personally, I think we should just get back to phrenology. The bumps on your head, the way it's shaped, right? I mean, come on now. That seems as good as any other. I'm just kidding. Gary, tell us about Death's Pale Flag. But before we get into the actual who's it, what's it of the book, though, when did you know you're practicing physician, you're a surgeon? When did you start feeling like, I really want to write fiction? Was that when you were actively practicing, or did that kind of come when you became more of an educator of up and coming surgeons? So tell us a little bit about your journey to becoming a fiction writer.
Yeah, I guess I can't really pin it down. I think I've always enjoyed stories, and I've always enjoyed it just getting ideas down here and there, but I, frankly, just never had the time to put anything really together.
Yeah,
it was a crazy busy world. I mean, crazy busy. And as I said, I've written a bunch of I have 3 nonfiction books out on burnout in healthcare, and I also, you know, you write all sorts of stuff when you're in that world of, you know, for journals and all that sort of thing. But I guess as I went along, every so often I would see something happen, or I would experience something, in the operating room or whatever. And we would always kind of say to each other, you can't make this stuff up. This, the stuff that we're seeing is beyond what a fiction writer can come up with. And I always thought, well, it would be nice for people to know about this world, because I think it carries a lot of lessons with it, just about, how for us, we see people when their lives have come completely off the rails in one way or the other, through disease, through trauma, through their own bad judgment, one way or the other, their lives have come completely off the rails. And I always thought, well, the more people understood what the repercussions are of some of this stuff, probably the more they'll appreciate what they have now. And anyway, long story short, I always thought I'd like to write a book about, just what we're seeing and what we're experiencing, what the surgery's like for sure, what our lives are like, but really what's happening to the patients and how brave they are and how brave their families are and stuff like that. So, I'd write down little snippets and thought I'd put it all together. And I started putting it all together while I was still working. And I was like, oh, God, this is boring. It feels like a book report. I think people are going to, pick it up and say, oh, man, this is just too much work. So that's when I got the idea. I was still working and I thought, geez, if I could come up with a fiction book and that shows it, but keeps compelling the reader forward. So originally, while I was working, it was a totally different story. It was going to be a neurosurgeon working at Walter Reed who starts getting politicians in with very similar problems, these aneurysms that rupture.
Ooh.
And he begins to suspect that something's going on, remembers some articles where, a certain toxin could create these bizarre aneurysms anyway. And it turns out to be a plot to knock off pro-abortion politicians. Anyway, I got well into it. And I just said, oh, this sucks. So I got to come up with something different. I think it may, could have been just by its timeliness now, probably could have, I don't know, sold some, but who knows? I didn't like it in the end. And then I was just like, I don't have the time to really do it, the due diligence it needs. So upon stopping surgery, I had more time, although that seems to have evaporated. But anyway, that's when I sat down and tried to create a whole new story, a whole new approach.
Was it, but once you finally figured out this is the groove, you got into that groove, did it come pretty fast at that point, or?
Yes and no. And you'll have to tell me how you are, Alex, when you get into your writing spells. But, because I know everybody's different, and there are people who talk about, crafting each sentence and each word of each sentence. For me, I call it verbal dysentery. I just, I would sit down and it would be, just finished breakfast. And then I would look up and it was dinner time.
Yeah.
And, there'd be 100 pages or something. And I overwrote, in other words. And then, the big effort came to, paring things down and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting, which I actually enjoy. So that helps. But yeah, that original is just poured out on the page.
I love that. When you're just cranking away and everything's great and you look up and it's been hours. I just reach for my coffee and it's cold. And it's the best feeling. Cause then, like you said, you'd have either, if you didn't have stacks, literally you could go back and look at your page and your word count and just go, oh my gosh. Wow. Yeah. But to your point, same here. I mean, yeah, it's by no means all good, but it's, I just always say to the universe, thanks for the clay. I can start to mold this now, because to me, get that clay on that table is tough. And I've done, my series, like 8 books, and the first one was horrible to get through, to get it finally done. The second one just fast, third one fast, but then it started slowing down for me. It became tougher. And then, you know, then the doubt creeps in. Oh, have I said all I have to say? Are these characters tired? This last book really didn't sell that well. Why am I doing this? Shouldn't I be doing something else? All these things creep in, but then you just have to shut them out of the room, close the door, and get back to writing. And that's what I tell writers all the time. It's just like the number one piece of advice I have is get your butt in the seat and start writing. Somebody disagreed with me on that, and they said, well, you don't have to be in a seat. I said, well, I don't mean to be, don't be pedantic. I just mean write, okay? Well, I have a standing desk. That's fine.
That's okay.
But you know.
You can do it on a treadmill if you want.
If you want. You can talk into a tape recorder if that works for you. That's your business. AI will help you with that. But I've loved the reviews of the story, but what's interesting is that a lot of people remark about the humor and the humanity of your lead. I'm wondering, because I can already kind of wonder if he might be a little bit like a guy we're meeting today. But tell us a little bit about your lead. Tell us a little bit about, if you would, without giving anything away, of course, what's going on in this book?
Yeah, well, thanks. It's about a neurosurgeon, you know, a totally narcissistic effort on my part. But again, I really wanted to get that world out. So it focuses on a neurosurgeon who's really, you know, good and at the top of his game, but things begin to creep in, and some of it is certainly just the overload of work. He's mm-hmm. a bit of a workaholic. He really cares about his patients. And in fact, I was just talking to some med students the other day, and I was saying, you know, here's going to be your challenge in life. You know, can you be a good father, a good family man, a good husband, if you're a good physician, in that if you are good at what you do, particularly if you're good to your patients, they'll beat their way to your door. You know, you will become busier than you want to be very quickly. And that's the case here. He's overworked. He's in a major trauma center. He deals with a lot of death, a lot of pathos, a lot of, I think sometimes when you're in the middle of that, particularly in one of these trauma centers, it just feels like life is so arbitrary. People are just being picked off right and left.
Yeah.
But anyway, so it's clearly beginning to wear on him. He's showing, you know, all the signs of burnout. But what really hits is that, he begins to see things. And originally he thinks, well, maybe this is hallucinations brought on by sleep deprivation, because he's on one of these, you know, every few nights up all night situations, which we get ourselves into, or even could it be seizures? In other words, he's going for a neuroscience type explanation of it, but he eventually convinces himself that it's ghosts, that he is actually experiencing the dead, and he's trying to figure out why this would be happening to him. And he tracks down a whole bunch of the ones that he sees, and it just keeps escalating, and he kind of keeps spiraling both in his home life and his work life to the point where it reaches a crescendo, and we go from there.
And there are thrills and chills along the way, right?
Well, I think so. I think, and one of the things I wanted the readers to think about was what was actually scarier, the thrills and chills of, you know, what comes in through the ER doors or what's happening in the supernatural world.
I love that. My series, the lead has kind of a doppelganger. He thinks is following him around for book after book. And you know, I'm spoiling it for people who haven't read it, but I figure if you guys haven't read this by now, come on now. These are old books now, but he soon figures out it's really a manifestation of his own grief. And it's more psychological than physiological. Mm-hmm. And he gets the help he needs, and it starts to really help. But that doppelganger, as I call him, becomes kind of a character. A lot of people were kind of sad when the lead got better, because they kind of liked his running commentary and all that. But the point being, I think it's fun to do things like that. And that's what drew me, by the way, when we first connected about your, I was looking into that. And I thought, oh, this looks really okay. I can sink my teeth into a brain, people. There we go. That's kind of nasty, I guess. I'm telling you, I think that's great. You touched on something, by the way, that I think is so important. And again, I've just met you, but I can see this with you already. I guess it's somewhat called bedside manner, but the idea that that if you're really good with people as a physician, they will beat a path to your door. One reason I've been with my physician for 18 years is because I absolutely love the guy. He takes time to talk to me. He listens. He's pleasant. He makes a joke, you know. I understand, back to your point about hours and hours and hours, and sometimes you have to be curt and quick and move. But you also have to, besides being a pleasant guy to keep patients, you have to occasionally deliver some really bad news. And I know you're noted for your expertise in that area. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would, because I wonder if the listeners, there's probably very few out there who have not had to hear some bad news about themselves or somebody in their life. I'm just curious about how you approach it.
Yeah, I mean, it is a huge part of your life if you're in my business, and particularly at one of these big medical centers where the helicopters are coming in every couple of minutes. It always feels like we lived right under the helicopter path, and it always felt like every one of them was coming to see me, kind of. You know, it wasn't the case, but man, you just, every time you'd be like, oh, here we go.
Here we
that
go.
Phone's going to ring in another couple of minutes.
It's choppers, but, on MASH. Choppers.
Well, it's like it, I swear. But you know, what you got to realize, though, is every time it flies over, and frankly, every time you hear the siren, you know, the ambulance siren going in, somebody's life is just being turned totally upside down. And so I gave bad news, you know, it's almost beyond comprehension. And there's a fair amount of it in the book, actually. But there'd be nights we would see, I tallied it up over time, but we saw 70% of our emergency consults between midnight and 6 in the morning. So it's kind of funny, you know, it all seems to go down at night. But anyway, there'd be nights where I might tell 5, 10 families that a loved one is dead, brain dead, paralyzed, has a brain tumor, is in coma. You know, I mean, you go from one to another sometimes without stop. And there's, I talked about this with my own team multiple times and a lot of other neurosurgeons in my burnout work. And you would think that this might drag you down, and it certainly will if you don't find a way to bear it. But actually, a lot of people talked about how in some ways there's an uplift, if you will, to it, because it's a real chance for humanity, for you to be a doctor, not, you know, come in and, you know, we've got a subdural hematoma with needs evacuation and the chances of life are blah, blah, blah. But to actually sit down and be a human being and talk to the family and listen to what their concerns are, understand what their understanding is, and really get to the bottom of things and try to help alleviate whatever suffering you can. And I think if you come out of one of those interactions feeling like you've helped the people, even if you haven't helped the patient, you've actually made some ground. So, you know, to get to your question, I think it takes a huge amount of humanity. It takes empathy. It takes taking the time, as you pointed out, to listen. Probably first and foremost, you know, understand where they're at, what they need, what they've got down so far, and also to really get an assessment of their ability to comprehend, you know, the complexities of it, because you're going to have to translate no matter what. You're going to have to translate. Even if I'm talking to another doctor, I have to translate the neuro side of this to something that, you know, they're going to more readily understand. And so you spend most of your time when you talk to patients and their families translating for them all this science to something that's digestible and that they can act upon. And so, you know, it takes time and caring. You also have to show a level of competency and confidence, right? You know, often on the shows, we may portray a lot of docs as being kind of arrogant. Maybe there is some arrogance there, but you know, the families, the patients, they expect you to know what you're talking about. And you've got to somehow project, yes, I know what I'm talking about. Therefore, you know, when I'm telling you, you can you can take to the bank. And it helped in my later years where I was able to roll in and say, you know, here, I'm Dr. Simmons, and I'm the boss here. And I would say I'm the boss here, not of the whole thing, but of neurosurgery. And I've been doing this for decades, and here's what I can tell you. Here's what I know, and what we're going to do about it. And I think you have to be very forthright and honest. They can sniff out very quickly if you're not. On the other hand, you can't come in and beat them to death with reality.
Right.
So, I mean, it's a complex dance that some people have a knack for. Most people get better the more they do it. But I think you have to do it with thought and intentionality. I usually tell people, for example, when you're going to give bad news, when you're going to deliver it, don't go straight from the patient's bed to this room full of super nervous people. Go somewhere, take a couple deep breaths, think about how you want to deliver this, what you want to say,
Right.
so that you go in with a plan rather than just winging it, because winging things often gets us in trouble.
Yeah, you just really can stumble. And that, to your point, people want someone who's calm and very competent and can fulfill the, can fill them with confidence that they're getting the best possible care. But you talk about burnout. It's that's got to be able to, but doesn't that contribute to burnout, at least with some physicians having to constantly deliver that kind of bad news? Do you train for, mean, it's weird because you just said, it's not weird, it's, but it's interesting to me because you just said that we have to be human here. But also, isn't there something you train for where you can't be too human and care too much? Does that sound silly? I guess, can you get too wrapped up in the emotions your patients are feeling and their families are feeling, and that could affect your ability to provide the good care? Or am I just watching way too much TV?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think, you again, think of that example of having several in a night. If
Yeah.
you can't just fall to pieces and then go give the next bad news, or fall to pieces and all of a sudden you're running to the OR for an emergency operation. Somehow you've got to shut it off. And I think most of us in the business are very adept at shutting it off. I think that's a danger in and of itself, where, if you close yourself off from your emotions too much, it's going to take a toll somewhere. It's going to come out somewhere. So, for example, kind of the typical, you were very kind about your description of neurosurgeons. I would argue the typical description of a neurosurgeon, if you get into a system, is that they're pretty irascible, they're quick tempered, they bark, they bite, they're very condescending, they're
Really?
snapping. Yeah, I would say that's a fairly
Wait,
universal
Dr. Simmons, I missed it then because that was the cardiologist where I was. They were just really not in the mood for me ever. I don't know what I did wrong. But the neurosurgeons were like, yeah, come on in, man. That's great. They were really laid back, like you are.
Well, that's cool, and it's good to hear, because that's what we want. But I would argue that most of the neurosurgeons who aren't behaving all that well, it's probably not because they're narcissistic pricks. It's probably because this has chipped away at some of their reserves, and
Right.
they have to be perfect for the patients and their families. It comes out somewhere else. And in my I guess one story that I tell with some frequency now, but it's because I'm still trying to figure it out myself. But during my time doing all this stuff, I can't remember ever crying,
Oh.
being so affected that I cried. Like in the book, our protagonist a couple of times breaks down, not necessarily in front of the patients, but after just taking his leave of the patients. And I don't think I ever did. I think I was very caring, but I think I was very good at walling off the emotions. But the weirdest thing happened the day I stopped doing that is I cry at the slightest provocation now. I mean, I joke, but I can watch a cat food commercial sometimes and feel tears running down my cheeks. And I'm like, what the hell is this? What is wrong with you? And I think it just all got so suppressed that once you took All the pressure off of it, it just wells up anytime it wants. And I think it's probably healthy, but it's really interesting, when you look at it yourself.
It's so nice to hear you say that. I imagine we're in the same ballpark in age. I have a 15-year-old daughter, and I noticed that my ability to staunch tears when I'm talking to her about something important. I don't cry every time I talk to her. That would be awful and strange. But there's
Well, a
moments.
teenager will do that
Well, that's true. But
to
I remember I got a very big break on a publishing deal. It was more money than I ever seen. It was one of those things. But I was telling her, and I got all because it was like my dream, and it was like it's happening. You know what I mean, Gary? And I was so overwhelmed. I welled up because I was like, and this is what's going to happen. And then she got all teary, and I said,
you.
what are you doing? Why are you? She goes, well, because you're going to cry, and I could tell. And I'm like, oh no. But then I realized I'm glad she sees me do that. And I think it's good for her to see that a man, all that stuff. Not that that's what you're talking about, but to your the what triggered you, me thinking about that too, was I was watching, I love MASH. I know. I was watching an episode of MASH, and there was some very moving scene, and I'm crying. Not boo-hooing, but it's definitely there. I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good relief valve, but I think it took me getting into my 50s before I could really embrace that. I don't know.
No, I 100% agree, and it's great to hear that that you're able to do that. And as I said, I suppressed it, I think, so much that it came out in spades. But I'm a better person for it, I think. I think all that suppression, as I say, it's going to come out somewhere. I talk about, one of the metaphors for burnout is it's like we have a bank of psychic energy, emotional energy within us all, and everything we experience is either making a deposit, something good, or making a withdrawal. And that when you're burned out, you're overdrawn, you're significantly overdrawn. And I think what happens for anybody is that when you get really overdrawn, you don't have the energy to put up the veneer we put up, over our idiosyncrasies so that we can interact with people. So I always say, I'm from New Jersey originally. I don't believe you can be from New Jersey and not be sarcastic and cynical. And so, I think back in those times, I wasn't a yeller or a thrower, but I think what would happen is really acerbic sarcasm would start coming out, where instead of self-deprecating, it would have an edge to it, or a sharp edge where it would hurt people. And I don't want to do that. But it would, I think it would come out that way for me specifically. The next person might be a thrower. It gets pent up one way or the other, and it blows out. So yeah, I agree with you. If you had a pop-off valve for those emotions, which wasn't harmful and every so often could decompress it, I think would be good. And I think allowing ourselves to have real emotions is probably one way to do it.
100%. And I was very similar, Gary. I was very acerbic in my younger years, and admittedly, I was not under high pressure like you were. Literally, people's lives in their hands. But everybody's pressure is relative to their situation. And but I tended to, be acerbic and sharp with people. But like you, never meaning to hurt anybody. It's just the way I express my emotions, I guess. But as I got older, mellowed out. I don't know. Isn't that what they used to call it? Mellowing out. I don't know. I think that's where we are. But Gary, this has been fascinating. I am excited about this book. I'm going to ask you, what's next?
Well, I've actually got another one in the can right now, just final touch-ups and stuff. Like an idiot, I haven't followed any of the, you know, prescribed ways of being successful writers, where it is in a totally different genre. First of all, this whole genre thing took me by, you know, it bit me on the butt, because when Death's Pale Flag came out, everybody's going, "What genre is it? What genre is it?" I'm like, "Oh my God, I don't know.
I
I
don't
don't
know.
know. What do you
Just
call
a good
this?"
story. It's what it is.
But this is like in a totally different scene. So it's another novel, but it's kind of, I guess you'd call it YA. It's a coming of age of a soccer player, because I love soccer too. You know, I just write about stuff I love. So this is a coming of age story about a soccer player.
Oh my gosh, that is wildly divergent
You say
from
you could
the
say that
thriller.
again.
But wow, but that's good. I think that's, see, there you go. It's neuros. You neuro guys, you're all just very, you are. I really believe this. This is my medical opinion. Neurosurgeons and neuroscientists, all you folks about the brain are wired different than the rest of us. There you go. There you go. But my prescription for our listeners is, of course, I had to do it, is go read this book. I'm going to tell you what. Gary has a great website. It's Gary R. Simmons, and that's Simonds. G-A, well, I'll spell it again. GarySimonds. But guess what? He is all over the socials. It would take me 20 minutes to read them all to you, but you're in luck. You don't have to pull over the car. You don't have to hop off the treadmill. Just go to the show notes at mgopod.com, and you're going to get a nice picture of Gary. You're going to get the book cover picture. You're going to have all these links. And of course, you're going to have the way to go buy them. Hey, I often ask this to my guest, Gary. Is there a particular place you prefer people to buy? Some people are like, don't buy it from Amazon. Some people, I don't care. Some people say, order it from your local bookstore. You have a preference?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to get them wherever it's easy for you. We
Right.
certainly try to support the independent booksellers, and you know, there's a whole independent bookseller site where you can tap into it, and they donate to the bookstores, or the, you know, the independent bookstores get it. But yeah, wherever works for you, I would argue is the best place. And there's an audiobook, which actually I was pretty happy with. I didn't read. They asked me if I wanted to read it, and I started, and I was like, "Oh God, this sucks." And have you done that with audiobooks, where you've listened to a whole bunch of different
I have it,
auditions?
and I did my first book has read, and my last book in my series has been done, and then there's a new beta test that's going on that I got invited to through Amazon, where AI reads it. I prefer people to AI as far as that. I mean, it wasn't as scarily good, to be honest, but I still, John Edmondson and Scott Bartley have read my two of my books, and they did a superior job. But the idea, and then I have actually read on one of my nonfiction books, and that's enough for me on that, because I think I have a bad voice or anything. I just was like, this just really takes a long time.
It
And
does, doesn't it?
yeah.
And you do have a good voice for it, so
Oh,
you would do
thank you.
fine. But I do a lot of audiobooks, because I'm always driving back and forth to Virginia, where Virginia Tech is, and I'm down in North Carolina now. But
Oh.
the audiobooks that drive me crazy is where they try to put on too many characters' voices differently. And particularly if it's a little girl and the guy reading is a, you know, a guy with this big husky voice. And I'm sitting here like, oh God, man, you're destroying this. So I went through a lot of those auditions, and the gentleman who reads it does very little of that, you know, false inflection. And for me, it works very nicely.
Yeah, I think the secret to that is, it just, you can subtly change
Yeah.
the timbre of the pitch a little bit, maybe even the cadence of certain characters, but trying to do that, like my big cast characters, man, Scott Bartley, who read mine, he was like, please tell me I don't have to like do women voices. Like, I was like, no, please don't. Cause you're right, Gary, it's comical and unintentionally, it takes you right out of the book. But I do love occasionally though, the authors who are really good at reading their own work too. And
Yeah.
I'm, I've just been listening to the late Gore Vidal read his last memoir, and nobody reads Gore Vidal like Gore Vidal. And I'm just like, this is great. I wish he had read Burr, which is my favorite novel he wrote about Aaron Burr, but he didn't. But anyway, Gary, I have kept you way too long because you're way too interesting. I tell you what, I'd like to just let you know the door is open. Come back with your next book or your next project. We'd love to hear more from you. We just scratched the surface of the brain, which sounds kind of, that sounds kind of wrong. Let's don't scratch anybody's brains. Gary Simmons, thank you. I pronounced it correctly this time. Sorry about that. Is the author of Death's Pale Flag. He is an expert, obviously, in neurosurgery and burnout and so much more. And he's just a damn fun guy to talk to. Gary, thanks for joining us here on Mysterious Goings On.
Oh, it is my delight. So thank you so much, Alex.
Thanks for joining us on Mysterious Goings On. Be sure to follow Mysterious Goings On wherever you get your podcast and never miss an episode. Don't forget, you can get the links to books and other things mentioned on the show at mgopod.com. Until next time, keep reading.